From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gralat, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. This week, China dipped a toe into the waters of Middle East diplomacy by hosting back-to-back visits with Palestinian Authority leader Mahmoud Abbas and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
What they were doing is putting down a marker and sort of saying, we are here and we're beginning to make statements.
We'll also discuss the hunger strike by dozens of the detainees at Guantanamo Bay.
This hunger strike really has gotten the administration to pay a little bit more attention, so maybe it has been successful.
And I'll talk with a journalist from ABC Radio in Bangladesh about the Rana Plaza garment factory collapse.
The owners, they want to save money, and they go for a cheap building, which is not really fit for his industry.
We'll talk about the textile industry's lack of government oversight after this hour's news headlines from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gralat. Joshua Landis, Rebecca Cruz. Interesting stories in the international news this week. Joshua, for you, China seems to be kind of dipping their toes a little bit, maybe, in Middle East diplomacy. They just hosted visits from the Palestinian Authority, as well as the Prime Minister of Israel. They seem to have presented a plan for some sort of peace negotiation,
a four-point plan.
So what's going on here? China actually kind of meddling a little bit in the Middle East on these issues?
It is. It's becoming more assertive. And about 5 years ago, they tried to do this with the Syrian president when he was visiting and the Israelis were present. They tried to make a meeting between them. It didn't work at all. But they have been asserting themselves more and more in the Middle East. And that's a product of the United States, in a sense, withdrawing. And China is becoming much more self-confident. Now, their four-point plan was basically land for peace, two states. It was a rehash of what United States presented like 20 years ago.
But they actually did come down on that. You've got to stop the settlements. You've got to stop bombing civilians. I mean, they were actually coming down a little bit on the Israelis about this, right? I mean, I suppose it wasn't the same kind of, you know, Israel, let's let you just kind of do what you want to do. I mean, they were pretty much taking a stance on this, were they not?
They were. It sounded like a 20 years ago plan. And life has gone on. And today there are 500,000 Israelis living in the West Bank, which is supposed to be the Palestinian state. And then, you know, it's hard to conceive of how that would change, how they would leave and this land for peace is going to work. Certainly in the configuration of the politics today with a very weak Palestinian leadership and a strong Israeli leadership that does not want a two-state solution, it's hard to see how something like that's going to happen. But they, you know, what they were doing is putting down a marker and sort of saying, we are here and we're beginning to make statements. And that will weigh on Iran.
Well, that's the question, right? Because they obviously have been quite supportive of Iran, or at least they're not willing to take a hard line against Iran's nuclear program.
20% of all of China's energy imports come from Iran. So they don't want to cut Iran off. We've been trying to get them to stop importing oil and gas from Iran, and they've refused because they depend on it terribly. And this is they're getting a little tired of us trying to make decisions. And in Syria too, they're
not supportive of sanctions against Syria, or at least tightening the screws a little bit there.
And they vetoed in the UN a proposal to move against Syria.
So they have an interesting I don't know, this is an interesting development, right, in that they're trying to play some role perhaps in the Palestinian-Israeli situation. But is it the case, do you think, that the Chinese could be seen as more of an honest broker on this issue, more objective, if you will?
Because the Arabs will definitely see it that way.
Really, it hasn't been an honest broker
on this
issue.
It's really – there's some of this power play that's going on with the United States, but I think it's also what Joshua pointed out. It's the oil revenues that they're needing, or the energy resources that they need. If they're getting 20% from Iran, they're getting over 50% from the region, and that's expected to reach 70%. I think the other calculus here is not only that China is asserting itself in the international arena, but also that China has this rising middle class that they're having to give fuel to. They're having to heat homes.
Absolutely.
They're having to fuel cars.
And the United States is becoming self-sufficient.
Yes.
And as we become self-sufficient, China is now Saudi Arabia's biggest trading partner, and Iran too. So you can see a day where the United States is going to take a much smaller interest in the Middle East and in defense structure in the Middle East.
But never regarding Israel, right? I mean, they're not going to
in that regard. But China has to walk a very thin line here. They have to be very careful. They want to keep Syria and Iran happy, but they also are trading more and more with Israel and want to get in that situation as well.
But fundamentally, this is where the struggle comes down to, because the United States has been a great world power in part because we've had our hand on the great oil tap mm-hmm. in the Persian Gulf. And that threat of using that against China has been our main card. We stopped Hitler because we denied him oil. And in a sense, in planning for Third World War, it's all about control of the oil. So the notion that America is just going to waltz away from the Persian Gulf and hand it over to China.
Absolutely not likely. And as China steps up in the Middle East, this may, I don't know, reverse some of the U.S. interest in pulling back from the Middle East. Well, we'll definitely see what happens there. So let's move to a different region of the world and talk a bit about Guantanamo Bay. Now, this has been an ongoing issue for a long time, not necessarily on the front pages anymore. But what we've got going on in Guantanamo right now is a hunger strike that approximately 60 of the 160 or so detainees currently at Guantanamo are in their third month of a hunger strike. Some are unhealthy enough to be force-fed at this point. And so they have a lot of claims. I mean, it started simply enough, right? There was an issue with the raids and cell blocks and the improper and inappropriate handling of the Quran, that it was handled disrespectfully. But now they're pushing on this whole, when are we going to get out of here? Right. This whole hunger strike has grown from you've treated us poorly to you're treating us so poorly. And when are we going to get out of here? What is behind this, Rebecca? And what are we expected to see with Guantanamo as we move forward?
Well, I think you're exactly right. And what's behind it is kind of they've been there, many of them, for over a decade now. We have this area in Gitmo where we're keeping these folks that we don't necessarily know what to do with. President Obama in the 2008 election said we will close down Guantanamo Bay and didn't do it. And so they're really trying to draw attention back to the situation there. Much of America has forgotten that we have this detention area just about 90 miles off our coast with these 160 or so prisoners.
We're holding people without trial.
Yes.
And that brings up the question of torture, holding mm-hmm. people without trial, a special legal case during a time of war against terrorism. And is that war ongoing? Is it over? If it is over, do we close that? And that's in a sense
that's
what Obama
issue.
Promised us, is that this would be the end of a war.
Right.
We'd killed bin Laden, and now we're going to close this thing.
The problem is, what do we do with them? We don't know what
to do. Not just that. There is evidence that some that have mm-hmm. been released from Guantanamo have actually a certain percentage, around 17-20%, that have actually gone back and become actively engaged once again in terrorism.
Recidivist.
Others that are suspected of engaging. And then we've raised some hopes regarding release. There mm-hmm. actually were some announcements made that some of these prisoners would be released, and then the administration pulled back from that. So really, I mean, it's about their treatment, their indefinite detention without trial, as you mentioned, Joshua. But I mean, the fact is that, you know, the facility itself has declined substantially over this 11-year period that it's been in existence. The treatment continues to be, they go from being isolated to, you know, being able to live together and work together. They never know what to expect. And I think they're just, it's a desperate situation. They have no hope. They see no light at the end of the tunnel, and people really don't kind of care about this issue. You know, they consider them to be terrorists, and they don't care. So what on earth are we going to do about this? Can we close it? Can we move them? I mean, we just seem to be stuck in a pattern of we don't know what to do, so we're just going to continue to do what we're doing.
Well, we don't know where we'd move them to. If we brought them to the United States, put them in prisons here, they would have to be isolated. So we really don't know. The president, though, has come out, and I would say that this hunger strike really has gotten the administration to pay a little bit more attention. So maybe it has been successful in that essence. And President Obama and his administration have come out and said, yes, we are dedicated to this. We are going to advance. We are going to try to find a solution. What that is, they don't appear to know, and that's really anyone's guess.
Well, Joshua, Rebecca, thank you very much, as always, for your insightful analysis.
Thank you.
If you have a comment about this program or a question for any of our panelists, let us know by email at worldviews@ou.edu. You can also follow this broadcast in real time on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU. Coming up after a short break, I'll talk about last month's garment factory collapse in Bangladesh with Shima Bhoumik. She's a reporter with ABC Radio in Dhaka and just wrapped up a 3-week assignment in Oklahoma through a program with the U.S. State Department. I'm Suzette Grelot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Late Wednesday night, a fire broke out in an 11-story building housing a garment factory and a residential complex in Bangladesh's capital and killed at least 8 people. The fire comes just 2 weeks after a factory building housing 5 garment factories collapsed on April 24th. Shima Bhoumik is a reporter with ABC Radio in the country's capital city of Dhaka, and followed developments in her home country during a 3-week trip to Oklahoma. She worked with KGOU through a professional development program through the U.S. State Department. Shima Bhoumik, welcome to Worldviews.
Oh, thank you so much.
So you're visiting us from Bangladesh, where you serve as a journalist. You're
yes.
here studying journalism yeah. for a short period of time. What can you tell us about the main differences between journalism in Bangladesh versus journalism here? So far, what has your experience been, and how would you characterize the profession in both countries?
When I see KGOU equipments, it's like, yes, we use all the equipments in Bangladesh also. But the thing is that way they cover news. It's a bit of difference, I'll say that. Because in Bangladesh, I'm a senior reporter of ABC Radio. And we do special news and general news also. So here I saw that your reporter is kind of their special correspondent-like. And the other thing is, yes, I went to the Capitol House, and anyone can go there, and anyone can see the house and what's going on there. But in Bangladesh, it's really not possible.
So you have more access
yes,
here than
yes,
in Bangladesh.
Yeah, I will say, yeah, it's a very good thing in here, which we're not able to do in Bangladesh. We have to carry one card, and specifically, if you have this card, then you can enter this building. And here I also see that you can carry your phone, laptop, whatever you want. But there is really not
there
possible.
Are more restrictions
yes,
on being able
yes.
to do your job.
So
in Bangladesh.
I think for news person, for a newsman, your media facilities is really more flexible than ours.
So is the goal of your program, the goal of your work here
yes.
then, to be exposed to different ways in which you conduct your profession so that you can take those practices home?
Yeah.
And if so, what do you expect when you return home to Bangladesh? I mean,
yes.
do you expect that some of these restrictions or limitations will change? Are you going to be able to maneuver them a little better?
Suzette, frankly speaking, I'll try to talk with my people, person, and also how your media works over here. Yeah, it's a very interesting thing, I'll say that. Yeah, what you said that, yes, I'm taking many of things, lots of things from here. Yeah, I'll try to implement it. The good thing, of course, the good thing, I'll implement it. I'll talk with my people that, yeah, it should work like that.
So to try to make some changes
yes,
in the way journalism
is
conducted in your country.
Yes.
Well, you've covered one of the many stories, as you've said,
yes.
you cover many stories in Bangladesh. One of the things that you've covered are financial markets.
Yes.
I mean, your country is new. It's
mm-hmm.
you know, it's only been an independent country since 1971.
Yeah.
And it's faced some very significant,
yes.
difficult financial times.
Yes.
So what is the current economic climate like
yes.
in Bangladesh today?
Suzette, the thing is, we are basically a growing up country, you know that. And we have some MDGs goals.
So the MDG goals, the
Millennium Development
goals.
Yes.
Yeah.
And yes, we are doing good in some extent. But the other thing, if I talk about our financial sector, yes, financial sector is growing, but our main problem is infrastructure problem. Because you said that we are just independent since 1971. It's a very young country. And we have power shortage, infrastructure problem, gas problem. Business, maybe they have money, but they can't build one factory or industry there. And
so banking and those kinds of infrastructural needs of an economy, banking, financial
yes.
being able to engage in financial transactions, communications,
yes.
technology. These are some of the things that your country is struggling with?
Communication is one problem. And if I say foreign direct investment, they are also interested to come in Bangladesh and invest in Bangladesh. But our main problem is infrastructure, gas, power, this type of problem. And when any investor saw that this problem I'll face here and my cost will go rise, so they don't feel interested. I think there is some opportunity for us.
Well, when you mention infrastructure, of course, I can't help but think about a recent event in your country
yes.
where a garment factory
yeah.
collapsed
yes.
and hundreds of people died and many more injured. And so this has a connection to your economic well-being and your ability to engage with the West. I mean, most of the customers of the garment factory are Western
yes.
And many American,
yeah.
European companies. So how do you make that connection? I mean, this was an unsafe workplace. And what is the likely outcome there?
As you said, that our customers is mostly they're foreigners like Americans or European. Yeah, that impacts very bad. And our garment sector is really rising. You know that China, Bangladesh, and I saw you when I visited your Walmarts and Ross. I saw some T-shirt, pants, fish tags
by things made
in Bangladesh.
Right.
Yes, yeah. When I saw that, I feel proud. Yeah, it's my product. It's my country product. But the thing is, you said, yes, there is lots of owners who just wanted to save money. In Bangladesh, the rent of a building is really too high. And the owners, they want to save money and they go for a cheap building, which is not really fit for his industry.
For the kind of equipment
yes,
and,
for kind of
and the weight that
yes.
will be in the building.
And experts says the Savar Rana Plaza building, which this accident, it will not happen if there is no heavy machineries, because there is five garments factory and there has lots of heavy machineries and the building didn't take this.
So are you likely to see some changes in,
yes.
in practices in
yes,
Bangladesh
of course.
Because of this?
Of course.
I mean, it seems like people are outraged by this.
The thing is, this kind of accident is happening in Bangladesh last few years. But I would say, and expert also agree with me, government should have more strict for their position. If they really want to flourish our economy, flourish our garment sector, export sector, then I think government should be more strict. Because in Savar Rana Plaza, if you see that thing, the owner hadn't any license to do that kind of building. And he just used two or three rod for to building a nine-storied building. It's ridiculous. And there is no, they don't get any.
So it's not that the restrictions aren't there, it's that they aren't being enforced. He didn't have permission to do in those buildings.
They don't have permission.
What they needed, and what they were doing.
And the owner, when they saw that this building is cheap for rent, and they just rent it because they want to save money. And talk about cheap labor. Yeah, there is some problem. And we have some labor union. They want to just bring it in some standard. Yeah,
to establish
wage.
Some minimum yes. standards, some
yes.
minimum wage,
yes.
basically.
Yes.
I mean, it was mainly not only families of those that were lost in this most recent tragedy, but labor unions
yes.
that are out there on the forefront trying to make
yes.
these changes. So that raises the question then about the government of Bangladesh
yes.
and the, as we've talked about economics and the financial issues. But what about the stability of the government? Again, you're a young country. You're situated in a very interesting part of the world between India and Myanmar and near Sri Lanka, Pakistan,
yeah.
China. I mean, you're in what some might consider to be a volatile and difficult region.
Yeah.
I mean, what can you say about your government and its relations not only inside the country and its stability inside the country, but its relations with its neighbors?
Yeah, to some extent, I'll say that the relation with other country, like India is our neighbor country, and Myanmar also. And if I talk about Asia, Pakistan, Sri Lanka is also our neighbor. But the thing is, with India, our relation, government relation is not too bad. But the thing is, we have some problem also in border killing. Indian government always say, yeah, we'll stop this. But these things happen every alternative day. And if I talk about Myanmar issue, then the Rohingya's problem is a major problem for Bangladesh.
So is it tension over the border itself, yes, in terms of the line, the demarcation of the, yes, of the country and the peoples on each side that are engaging with one another? Or what is the actual context of the of these border killings?
Basically, maybe Indian authority say that our people want to go there illegally, then they shot.
So okay, so it's an immigration crossing of borders.
Yes, but if anyone cross the border, they will arrest him or her. They can't shoot her, but we don't do this thing of killing in our side. And I say about I talked about Rohingya issues. Yeah, they just illegally cross the border and they come and they settle here. And you know, our population already in 16 million people, over 16 million people, and we are a very small country, so it's very. Yeah. And the other thing is, in recent findings, we saw that some poppy cultivation.
Yeah, so drugs. Concern, yeah,
yeah, poppy cultivation in Chittagong Hill Tracks area, and we are really afraid. And it proves that India-Bangladesh-Myanmar border is really creating some problem for us.
So, what about the larger context in terms of India and Pakistan? I mean, there's a lot of tension in that relationship. Do you often feel that you get pulled in between or any kind of fallout from that?
We are not really directly involved with Pakistan. Pakistan border is not near of Bangladesh. We are
the tension in the region. It's a tense region. Right?
But no, I'll say that no, we really don't feel any effect of this Indian-Pakistan tension. We really don't feel any problem.
Well, do you think Bangladesh serves as a perhaps a mediating force? Is Bangladesh, despite its youth as a young country, kind of out there trying to, you know, make good relations in the make good on relations in the neighborhood?
No, Bangladesh is trying to, always trying to, but maybe your response, but your friends is not responding. So what will you do? That's a big problem.
I'm sure it's very challenging, without a doubt.
Yes.
Well, Sheema, thank you so much for joining us on Worldviews to talk about an interesting part of the world.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you, Susan.
You've been listening to my conversation with Sheema Bhoumik, a reporter with ABC Radio in Dhaka, Bangladesh. We have a transcript of this interview, as well as a series of reports she filed for KGOU's news department on our website, kgou.org. KGOU produces Worldviews alongside the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Our producer and digital content editor is Brian Hardzinski, and Mackenzie Samus prepared the research for this interview. For Rebecca Cruz and Joshua Landis, I'm Suzette Rolotte.